I would like to say, along with Bill, how happy we are to have everybody here, particularly our guests. And I would like to acknowledge especially the presence of a dear old friend, Bill Servin. Harriet are here this morning visiting with Joy Walker. It's hard to recognize Bill without the usher's tie, in which I used to see him all the time. It's wonderful to have you present, both of you. One of the best ways to get close to the mind of Christ, to hear his judgment upon our lives, is to study the stories he told called parables. And so the month of November is dedicated to four of those stories. The one this morning is about a lost boy, and most of us relate very well to the pain of a parent whose child is lost. One afternoon when our daughter was about 3 years old, I had a distress call from her mother. She had put Karen in her baby bed for a nap, but when she came in to check on her, the bed was empty. Since Karen had never gotten out of that bed by herself, you can imagine the calling of her name, the frantic search of every room, the dash outside, and then the call to me and to our small town police force. They got there even before I did and looked all around until the old sergeant said, "Ma'am, you did check her room." A lesser man might have been paralyzed by the look he got. But he was a stubborn, practical soul, and he insisted on going in to see for himself. And sure enough, there in the bed stood a composed and happy child who waved at him and said hello. A knowing little smile flickered between the sergeant and his fellow officer, but nothing mattered except having a lost child back. We never did find out how she got out of bed, or where she hid, or why she came back and crawled up into bed again. But that curiosity faded through the years, and about all we remembered sharply was the pain of thinking we had a child missing and no way of knowing what danger she might be in. It was a brief terror, but it gave us some idea of the anguish behind those television pictures of missing children. We also came to realize, as years passed, that there are other ways to lose children, to drugs, to some alienating mental illness, to careless friends who drink too much and drive too fast. To have a child in danger like that, wake up and come home, is a joy not matched by much else in life. There may have been in the neighborhood where Jesus lived a headstrong boy who grieved his parents by leaving home and losing himself with the wrong kinds of friends in the city, so that at night in the little cottages, other parents would whisper to one another, "Has anybody heard anything about Johnny? I saw his folks today at the market. They looked awful." And one day, years later, Jesus used a story like that to explain how gladly and graciously God welcomes his own children who have forgotten who they are. The story goes like this. Two brothers lived in the same house, close enough to say hello at breakfast, but in disposition, miles apart. The younger one, I imagine, to be good-looking, high-spirited, and popular. He decides one day that home is too confining. His father has too many silly rules. He wants a freedom that has no restraints at all. Out there somewhere, beyond the disciplines of home, there must be exciting worlds where one can do whatever he likes, with no goody-goody brother to purse his lips and frown, no father to raise his eyebrows at some little peccadillo like jipping school or staying out too late. He talks to himself about it day after day. How am I supposed to grow up with somebody telling me all the time what to do? Total freedom with no restrictions. It has to be waiting out there someplace, and he resolves to find it. His dad believes that absolute freedom is likely to turn into absolute misery. He hopes to give a little more liberty all the time until his son is ready to set his own course. But that process is slow, and sons are impatient, and this son begins to grumble, "I need a break. I'm fed up with all this right and wrong stuff. I'm old enough to do anything I decide to do, and I can handle the consequences, whatever they are." So into his dad's room he comes one morning and says firmly, "Tomorrow, I plan to leave and be my own boss. I want you to give me my share of the inheritance." At dinner that night, the boy's uncle is over, or a friend from the farm next door who knows all about life. He says, "Oh, let him go, Jim. He needs to sow a few wild oats, get into trouble and out of trouble again. It'll make a man of him." And the older brother looks prim and pious and says, "Seems to me some people would want to stay around and help out, like I do, instead of running off with some wild crowd." And across the table, the one who came to be known forever after as the prodigal son stares at the table and thinks, "Oh God, anything to keep from being like that self-righteous son of a synagogue." Maybe the mother says something. If mothers in Palestine ever got to say anything about such matters. But it's the father's decision in that world, so they all look at him and wait. He surprises them. He gets up, gets the money, hands it over, gives his boy a hug, and says goodbye. Home, he knows perfectly well, is not home to a boy of alien will. All he can do now is what parents have done so many times since: wait and love and be ready if far down the road someday there is the welcome sight of a familiar face. It's not hard to imagine how that younger son felt when he left with his money in his pocket. He gets himself a new leather jacket, a late model BMW, and some friends who seem wittier than any he has ever known before, sharp and a little cynical, mocking things he had never thought of mocking, so much smarter than the old crowd back home. Weeks, months, years perhaps go by. No master but himself, no loyalties except to good times, until one day a very strange and unwelcome thought comes into his mind. There are times when this doesn't seem as much fun anymore as it did at the beginning. Times when it almost seems as boring as life on the farm. It occurs to him that he has developed some habits that control his life as much as his father ever did. He can't bear to be alone. This boy who had once loved to sit by himself down at the pond and wonder what his life would be like. And once or twice late at night when he has to be alone, he wonders for just a fleeting moment how loyal his clever new friends will be if he gets sick or runs out of money. But by morning, he has put that thought out of mind. And then one summer, the rains fail to come. The sun blisters all the crops. A dreadful famine creeps across the land, and the last of his money runs out. His friends discover they have important business somewhere else. And finally, desperate for food, he hires himself out to a Gentile farmer who sends him out to feed the pigs. Supreme insult for a boy reared in a Jewish home where swine flesh is unclean. A Gentile master who tells him when to get up, what to eat, how to do his chores. The great dream of freedom dead in the dirt of a pigsty. I suppose that one day, in the mud, eating, as we are told he had to do, some of the stuff the pigs ate, the truth hit him. There is no way to be completely free. We are always in bondage to something or someone. Some bondages are better than others. And it seems now that there was more real freedom in his father's house than he had thought. Freedom. What a demanding word that can be when we discover what freedom requires. I had a chance to go to West Point once and turned it down for several reasons I thought at the time and now were good. And after that, I spent a couple of years in the city of Oxford, free to attend lectures in any of the colleges, to watch the plays, to read in the great libraries, and to see the amazing freedom of the students. And I've many times thought about how different the two ways of life were. At West Point, the strictest of rules, class attendance, grade requirements, study hours, bedtime, everything run by the book. At Oxford, no roll call, no one checking or seeming to care what one did. Lectures posted for Balliol or Magdalen or St. John's or Christ Church. But if you didn't show up, chances were no one would ever know. There would come a time, at last, when an examination would show how you had put in your days, but meanwhile, you managed your own affairs. You could convince yourself that freedom was absolute, and that college life in that picturesque place was a snap, if you were that foolish. It seems to me that God has ordained human life to be more like Oxford in appearance than like West Point. It will appear at times that we can do whatever we like, that there are no limits or boundaries, but it is illusion. And the whole history of humanity confirms that over and over again. Every person who hunts freedom, apart from some compelling loyalty, winds up in bondage. Sometimes, like our young hero, in a wretched place that makes the dream of freedom seem like a dismal joke. So what's left for the protagonist of our parable? Well, for one thing, the image of his father's face when he left. A vision of home that has not quite ever faded, which is why mothers and fathers don't ever want to do anything to destroy that image. No final slamming of doors. No hateful words that make return possible. This prodigal son knows his father longs for him and waits deep in his heart through all the raucous noises of the far country. One bell has rung softly and persistently, and he finally hears it. Jesus, telling this story, says, when he came to himself, and that may be the greatest compliment he ever gave us, that there is a better self beneath the one we often show. We may not believe it, God help us, about our own children, about our wife or our husband, but he did. Positive that every one of us deep down wants to be loyal and decent and loved. That the far country is not where we really want to live. So this boy gets a speech made up and heads home in his filth and rags, wondering how he can bear the humiliation. He will be penitent, he tells himself. He will say, my father, I have done very bad things to you and in the sight of God, and I am not worthy anymore to be called your son. But he never has a chance to deliver the speech. His father, waiting in hope all this time, sees him coming down the road and runs to meet him. We miss the force of the word run. It was undignified in the Near East for an older man to run. Aristotle had said, great souled men never run in public. So Jesus is stressing that this father, in his welcoming love, forgets all about dignity and opens his arms without thought for himself. There is, by the way, a Buddhist parallel to this story, which makes the father put the returning son through a long series of tests to prove that his repentance is genuine. That's sensible, probably. But it's not the way of risk-taking love. It's what we do when we love logic or ourselves more than the one returning to us. Jesus knew better than that. He knew life itself will punish us when we miss the mark, and that what we always need then is acceptance and love and healing. So when the boy tries to stammer out his speech to say, I have no right to be taken back, but here I am, as so many children have had to say to their parents, as wives and husbands have had to say to each other, the father, without a word of rebuke, breaks in before the speech can get started and says, bring the best robe, because the mark of that ordeal needs to be covered, and a ring for his finger to show that he is a son, and shoes for his feet, because only slaves go barefoot. No probation, no word of reproof, no reminder of how painful the separation had been and what he had done to dear old dad. Only the glad, welcoming fullness of a father's love. One of the neighbors says, there will always be one of these. How do you know he won't leave again next week? And the father says, I'm sorry. I can't even think of anything like that right now. And that is why this parable is at the heart of the gospel, with its strange power to untangle twisted lives, to give a glimpse of hope in that crucial moment when we finally see that the far false country is not what we thought. It makes a promise that people can find their way back. And this is the place. This is the place where we remind each other that that can happen. That if we follow the wrong dream and wake up some morning lost, the vision of home may save our lives. The story is not really very fresh or original. It doesn't make for a clever sermon. It simply says that at some time in our lives, every one of us is the lost child. And that when we finally come to ourselves, someone will welcome us with love.